It's on 18th August, 79.
Yeah, well, we decided to build up a radiometer, and though the sensitivities, the noise figure wasn't all that low, at least one with a traveling wave tube, one could get a broad bandwidth. And so I built up a radiometer, which consisted of, there was a low noise traveling wave tube, and I think by low noise it was about 1500 degrees noise temperature. Mm-hmm. And I followed this by other amplifiers, such that the overall bandwidth was something like, was it 900? It was a few hundred megahertz overall bandwidth.
Pretty broad for those days.
It was pretty broad for those days, and in fact had as good a sensitivity as I know Algonquin Park had up to about 5 or 6 years ago. Mm. And this I set up with various difficulties that one had in keeping the gain constant. So I had various discharge tubes pulsed to keep the gain constant, and it was built up as a radiometer. But Ron Adji, who was with us at the time, he'd been supported by R.A. Smith in trying to detect the deuterium line. R.A. Smith kind of more or less thought the deuterium line, spectral lines, was physics, and that was all right, whereas the other stuff was radio astronomy.
I see. So this was really in response to the Russian claim of a detection, I believe.
That's right. That's right.
They had this paper in Nature saying they couldn't find it.
That's right.
I didn't realize that I knew Adji, and I didn't realize it was went on in the same place as Hay's group, but he was not really under Hay.
Yes, he was. Oh, yes,
he was.
Now who did we have? Hay's group. Ron Adji and I were two radio astronomers, and then there's Peter Smith, who was doing shock tube work.
I see.
And there was someone else who did this pulse light work as well, who was
so that was the same dish, the 45-foot dish.
It was the same 45-foot dish, yeah. But as Hay more or less said, that politically it was a good thing for Raji to get do these measurements on the 45-foot dish. Well, Ron Adji was a rather very pleasant sort of person, but he had no what you might call drive. So much so that I got a bit frustrated that you'd see the whole dish being left for the weekends, and he'd finish at 4:30 to go into his amateur dramatics, and he hadn't even got the equipment going before he tried to put it on the dish, and so anyway this got a frustration, and I got my radiometer ready and sitting by, and it was about this time that the first Sputnik went up, which was
October 57.
October 57. Okay. Well, in October 57, I'm not sure if we missed anything. I might have had some publications in between. Anyway, in October 57, when the Sputnik went up, we decided to have a meeting at RRE, and it was quite apparent that the Royal Radar Establishment didn't have a radar with sufficient performance to detect the Sputnik. And so the meeting, and we got together and decided that there was the 45-foot telescope, the radio astronomy group. And of course, there are always magnetrons and modulators and display units all over the labs of TRE. And so it was decided that the telescope would be taken out of the hands of the radio astronomy group. But I was given the job of running the radar in it.
Right.
And so it was a wonderful situation.
You got together a receiver. Very quickly.
That's right.
That's the idea.
That's right. Well, I was told to organize it, setting through, and any troubles go straight to the director. Mm. And so there was a real mixture of bits and pieces put together. I think it was 2.5 megawatt 5 microsecond pulse length magnetron with associated modulation techniques, and we had to import air cooling and water cooling as well on top of this tower, which wasn't made for it. And then the associated power units, which had to be in trailers down below, and then and the receivers, etc. And the actual display unit was in fact part of an airborne radar display unit, which is a matter of interest. Was the type of display that was used to map northern Canada. It was the display that was, there was one idea of mapping, which was to get the high resolution by building a waveguide array along the length of an aircraft, so that it was sideways looking,
yes,
and fly this over the ground, essentially synchronize the speed of a moving film with the speed of the aircraft.
I see.
And you build up, you get a map of the ground underneath. It was secret at the time, and I think there was a tie-in with Canada that in fact most of Canada was mapped this way. I don't know what's happened to the things since then. Well, this was the type of display that we used for the radar. And so we started the observing, trying to get echoes from the Sputnik. And in fact, this one achieved. One developed an observing technique. Essentially, one realized that the orbit essentially went up to a particular latitude on the Earth, and where its range didn't change much. And it said its height was known, that in fact you get a good chance of getting a radar echo.
Right.
And essentially using this simple...
Just normal incidence, basically, is which...
Yeah, well, if you think of the normal Mercator's projector, and you think of the orbit of the satellite, when it's at its northern and most southern extent,
yes.
And in fact its range isn't changing all that much. And if you
because its range is constant.
That's right, its range is constant.
You get a bigger, better
and
signal.
And so you can get there, and if the height is known, then in fact you've got the angle. Because the resolution was probably less than half a degree.
Right. Now, why was it that you wanted to do radar rather than passively? Did you want to get some information on the size of the thing? And
I didn't want to do it.
Well, or what was the motivation? For instance, at Cambridge, and Jarvis, they listened passively and calculated the orbit and all this sort of thing.
We built up arrays and we did some of that work also.
I see.
There was a meeting in the Royal Society, this proceeding of the Royal Society,
where all this was brought together.
All this was brought together. And Ron Angie was put on to looking at some of that.
I see.
Then Hubert Jent joined us about that time, I think.
How long did it take from the launching to get an echo?
Shortly, it was a week following the launch when we met to see what could be done. And then inside the next week, we met together and decided it could be done. And a week after that, it was done.
Sounds like the creation of the world.
It was, in fact, we
2.5 weeks. Yeah.
Something like that. I think you had to cross check on. If you go to the proceedings of the Royal Society, you find the date. The echo is.
Sure.
One of the echoes are there. Great excitement! In the middle of the night, we went and got a recording of it and processed it, and it was on the desk for the director when he came in the morning.
Now, what frequency was your traveling wave receiver at?
That was about 10 centimeters.
Okay, that's...
The actual detail.
Was that the one you used for this March 54 solar eclipse? You have a 10-centimeter observation
there. That was another... that was something else. Now then, I thought there was something else that one did for that. the solar eclipse was started, really, whilst we were in the Army Operational Research Group, and there was a solar eclipse with totality which passed over near to Baghdad. That was in 1954, and the Royal Society, or the Royal Astronomical Society, had funds for eclipse expeditions, and we seriously looked into the possibility of going out for the eclipse expedition to measure the decrease in intensity as during the eclipse and to try and get some idea of limb brightening on the sun.
Right.
Well, there's a whole problem of...
As NRL was doing several eclipse expeditions at that time, yeah.
That's right. There's a whole problem also of whether it had limb brightening or not, and this depended on variation in density and temperature in the upper atmosphere. We didn't go because, as you appreciate, that the optical astronomer, when he goes on the eclipse, just carries a few cameras or so and takes his photographs. And the amount of money that we would have needed to take a trailer and generators and everything was more than the rest of the people would
together.
So we did some measurements of the partial eclipse
from Malvern.
That was not conclusive whether there was limb brightening or not, and I forgot the details of that. I think
the abstract said you had some evidence perhaps for limb brightening.
Right. Okay.
But now, so this traveling wave tube then was being built in 57 or so,
this,
I guess.
This followed that eclipse.
And you had a paper in Proceedings of the IRE about using an argon noise discharge tube. That was part of your gains.
There were two things to that. One is essentially one produced an artificial sun for calibrating. We got a very good figure for the flux density from the sun. And essentially what it was to put an argon tube at the focus of a paraboloid, a small paraboloid. So essentially you produce a paraboloid for the particular size with a known temperature. And so this was a means of calibrating. But at the same time, having got to, I'm not sure it's before I went to Malvern, I did calibrate the argon discharge tubes for noise output. And this was because there was some equipment there which was very, very highly sensitive. You could calibrate attenuators to a very, very high degree. And I did this and actually measured the noise temperature of a discharge tube, but it was expressed in dBs in those days, of something like 15.75 to 2 decimal places in the dBs. And I think that value lived for a long time after that. It may still be alive now. And every now and then I see a reference to this. But that was something that... essentially, in those days, one didn't have much equipment, so one almost felt that one was kind of building up to what one would be doing in the future.
And it's, once again, I think that NRL was the only other place that was doing anything like this. I know that they were beginning to experiment with noise discharge tubes, I think, about that same time. Okay, but now you switched over. I wanted to ask, why was the Würzburg up on a tower? Why did you put it up?
Oh, that was because so you could look down low. Because what was the original Würzburg antenna? Was it the paraboloid? It was might have been a 20-foot diameter.
Oh, I see. Because you were making
we put a 45-foot diameter on a big addition. It had to be lifted up.
Yeah. Okay. But now it seems you gave a paper, the Paris Symposium, for instance, in the summer of 58, where you start talking now about lunar radar. So apparently this Sputnik radar got you off into radar.
That's right. As I say, I didn't really want to do this work, but actually Hay did persuade me to do it because he thought it was a good thing. And so, in fact, the first meeting to discuss whether or not it was possible to install the radar, the next meeting was yes, it was possible. And then I think there was another meeting in which I was asked how was I going to calibrate this radar, because the Rayleigh distance was something like 5 miles. And then and one thing that I had done in the meantime was to say, well, what can I use this radar for something that might be more useful in astronomy? And I hit on this idea of possibly using the moon. Because the moon, this is Crocker. Frank Kerr in Australia had used a local commercial transmitter to get an echo, and it wasn't all that difficult. And I thought, well, maybe one could do this. So at this next meeting, I was asked, how was I going to check the performance of the radar? I said, I'm going to get an echo from the moon. Whereupon the rest of the meeting, about 2 hours, was discussions on what one would expect to get from the moon and what were the scattering properties, etc. Well, in those days, it was thought that because the moon was a rough surface, therefore one would have Lambert scattering. In other words, each little Lambert would scatter as a cosine law. So that if you sent out a pulse, you get an echo coming back, which persisted over 1,738 kilometres. Is that the radius? I think I still remember it. And so, in fact, one was explaining that probably this is what would happen, so that since we were sending out pulses at the rate of 250 a second, I think it was, essentially these would sit up one on top of the other. You see, so this I went through, and I had to explain at the time how I was going to use the moon to calibrate the radar. Right. But one said, well, we next put in a sort of scattering or reflection coefficient, and one might be able to do it. But in actual fact. Yes. Well, okay, instead of getting the long echo corresponding 1,738 kilometres, in fact, the main echo came in inside 50 kilometres. So this was a little bit of a surprising effect. John Evans at Jodrell Bank used a long pulse and tried to Fourier analyze and try to get a system echo. And he claimed that the echo was coming from most of the surface, but that was because he'd made an error of 2 pi, I think, in his Fourier transform. He did come back later to show that it was a short pulse. But there's also, I think, someone in the States who, at about the same time, was using short pulses. I've just forgotten his name.
Well, I think that's at NRL, Yapley and company.
I think
they also gave a paper at the Paris Symposium.
They would be the other people. I'm not sure. They might have done it a little bit before I did, but they had security on it.
Right, but you didn't know about all this.
I didn't know about this. So
it was quite surprising to find this very short pulse coming back.
There are arguments followed up on that, by the way, in terms of the theory of scattering from the moon. And Straton and Talbot at the University of Texas, we arranged to do a joint experiment with them to transmit.
Do a bistatic radar.
Right. The argument there was that Senior and Siegel Tom Senior was an old pal of mine who came out to the States, immediately came out. We entered into a controversy as regards the scattering from the moon. They claimed it was regions of a size equal to a Fresnel zone, which was giving a specular echo. But I was saying that's nonsense. It's what you expect from a rough surface. I'd actually worked it out. I more or less said it was similar to fluctuations, scintillations that you get due to the ionosphere, and that if you assume the moon has a uniform reflectivity, then what you get back is the same as you get from a phase-changing screen through the where the phase changes with twice the depth of the mountains from or height of the mountains.
Right, right.
So I worked on this, and then with Straton and Talbot in Texas, I said the obvious thing was to do a space receiver experiment. Because if it was specular reflections, then in fact you get the same type of echo at two places, whereas if it wasn't, there'd be no correlation. And so we carried out that experiment, and I guess those other papers there are the ones.
Right, the one in 1960 actually is the main one.
Right, okay.
And which was it a clear result from this bistatic radar experiment?
Oh, it was a clear result that in fact it wasn't specular. And in fact, my recollection was that when we dip back in Malvern, there's a sharp rise, whereas in Texas there was a more gradual rise, as one would expect from a rough surface.
Mm-hmm.
But that whole subject has been taken further now.
Sure.
We couldn't carry that on, by the way, because of the terrific cost of high-powered transmitters and the technology. And it wasn't
feasible. You didn't try to go to planets?
No, we didn't try to go to planets. I tried to go for incoherent scattering from the upper atmosphere. But we just failed on that because of the performance. We pushed the techniques about as far as we could go, but just failed to, let's say in retrospect now, we're almost there, but not quite.
Yeah. Well, that's just about it as far as I'm concerned. Is there anything else that you'd like to say? One question I might ask you is, what would you have called yourself in the late 50s if someone asked you at a cocktail party, what do you do?
I think one would say I'm a radio astronomer, and in which case they'd immediately say, what's that?
Right. Right. But you didn't say radio astronomer, you didn't say electrical engineer or radar engineer?
No, radio astronomer, I think, was the term that we used.
Uh-huh.
And of course, it always start discussions then as regards to what it meant, and you'd have to go to the long extent and explain if you felt like it, but in those days one tended to be too busy.
Another point is that all these papers in the 50s are Hay and Hughes.
Right.
But I gather that Hay was pretty much more the administrator of this sort of thing, and you were doing most of the work.
Is that
a fair statement?
That is a fair statement. The reason why I finally left Hay, it was also, Malvern was a very pleasant place to live as well, which maybe one didn't have one's energy directed as it is these days, more to the production of papers and furthering of one's own ego and et cetera. There wasn't so much of that, in any case, if I weren't with Hay, where would I have gone? You see, I just seemed to be fascinated in radio astronomy.
You wanted to do radio astronomy in England.
That's right. That's right.
There's not that much of a choice.
Right. And it's often surprised me that I started off, as I say, being interested in radio.
Yes.
And also astronomy at school, and somehow or other
brought them together.
One did what one wanted to, I think, and I suppose one always has done this for some reason or other.
Yeah. Okay, thank you very much.
That is the interview with Vic Hughes on 17 August 1979 at the IAU in Montreal.